continue our studies in the book of Genesis. We read in Genesis chapter 43, and from the 15th verse, we're going to be dealing with a fairly lengthy passage this evening, so I propose to split it into two, and we'll read one section now, and later on in the service we'll read the second section. You will remember that Joseph has been exalted to the office of Prime Minister in Egypt, that his brothers have already made one journey down to Egypt in time of famine for food. Joseph had accused them, you will remember, of being spies and had kept one of their number as a prisoner until they could bring proof of the authenticity of their claims, that they were honest men, that they had a father and a brother still alive in the land of Canaan. And after a great deal of time, Eventually, we discover that Jacob is prepared to let Benjamin go with his brothers as they make their second trip down into Egypt. So the men took the gifts and double the amount of silver, and Benjamin also, and they hurried down to Egypt and presented themselves to Joseph. When Joseph saw Benjamin with them, he said to the steward of his house, "Take these men to my house, slaughter an animal and prepare dinner. They are to eat with me at noon." The man did as Joseph told him and took the men to Joseph's house. Now the men were frightened when they were taken to his house. They thought, "We were brought here because of the silver that was put back into our sacks the first time. He wants to attack us and overpower us and seize us as slaves and take our donkeys." So they went up to Joseph's steward and spoke to him at the entrance of the house. "Please, sir," they said, we came down here the first time to buy food. But at the place where we stopped for the night, we opened our sacks, and each of us found his silver, the exact weight in the mouth of his sack. So we have brought it back with us. We have also brought additional silver with us to buy food. We don't know who put our silver in our sacks." "It's all right," he said, "don't be afraid. Your God, the God of your father, has given you treasure in your sacks. I received your silver." Then he brought Simeon out to them, that is, out of prison, to them. The steward took the men into Joseph's house, gave them water to wash their feet, and provided fodder for their donkeys. They prepared their gifts for Joseph's arrival at noon, because they had heard they were to eat there. When Joseph came home, they presented to him the gifts they had brought into the house, and they bowed down before him to the ground. He asked them how they were, and they said, and then he said, "How is your aged father you told me about? Is he still living?" They replied, "Your servant, our father, is still alive and well." And they bowed low to pay him honor. As he looked about and saw his brother Benjamin, his own mother's son, he asked, "Is this your youngest brother, the one you told me about?" And he said, "God be gracious to you, my son." Deeply moved at the sight of his brother, Joseph hurried out and looked for a place to weep. He went into his private room and wept there. After he had washed his face, he came out and, controlling himself, said, "Serve the food." They served him by himself, the brothers by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves, because Egyptians could not eat with Hebrews, for that is detestable to Egyptians. The men had been seated before him in the order of their ages, from the firstborn to the youngest. and they looked at each other in astonishment. When portions were served to them from Joseph's table, Benjamin's portion was five times as much as anyone else's. So they feasted and drank freely with him. And we leave off our Bible reading in chapter 44. May God add his blessing to this reading of his holy word. It's an aide who was arrested, convicted, and imprisoned for his involvement in the Watergate scandal, had held high government office. He had known high honors. He was considered to be one of the sharpest legal minds in North America. After his conversion and release from prison, he founded the Prison Fellowship, which now operates in many countries around the world, including our own. And Colson, many years after the establishment of the Prison Fellowship, was reflecting upon the usefulness of his life, and he made these very astute comments. He said, "It was not my success God used to enable me to help those in this prison or in hundreds of others just like it. All of my achievements meant nothing in the economy of God. No, the real legacy of my life was my biggest failure, that I was an ex-convict. My greatest humiliation, being sent to prison, was the beginning of God's greatest use of my life." Now, that is not the kind of conclusion that one can easily arrive at. Indeed, it is the most natural thing in the world to think the opposite of that. We tend to think that our successes, which we have worked hard to achieve, are the very things that God will choose to use. Not our humiliations. And when he does that, we so often find that hard to swallow. Self-confidence is often the very last thing to go when God begins to do a deep work in the heart of a man or a woman. And this was certainly the case in the lives of Joseph's brothers. The brothers had managed, you will remember, for many years to preserve their dark secret concerning their treatment of their younger brother, Joseph. It had been carefully hidden from their father, from their younger brother, from their own wives and children, all that had happened out there in the desert by the side of that dry well. But God knew, and God was at work to expose their guilt in order to bring them into a right relationship with himself. Our God is a God who wounds in order to heal. And we have seen the way so far in which God has used physical deprivation, harsh treatment, imprisonment, as well as unsettling kindness, all to good effect, in softening up the brothers. But thus far, these things had not brought the brothers to a place where they openly and freely confessed their guilt concerning Joseph. God had still a deal of work to do in their lives to deliver these brothers from themselves. How was God going to proceed from here? in some church circles, there are those who would argue that the only thing that really awakens the conscience in the heart of a man is the terror of God's law. And for this reason, there are some who would argue that a law work requires to be done in a congregation in order to prepare men and women to receive and respond to the grace of God. And there are some who have determined to preach nothing but the terrors of God's law and the inevitability of judgment in the first part of their ministry. They would say that a person must first be slain by the law before he can be resurrected by the gospel. Now, in one sense, that is good theology. And that is often the way in which God works in people's lives. But there is a danger of imbalance. If we preach the law of God without also preaching the grace of God. Indeed, you will find that when we begin to examine men and women's responses to God, you will discover that invariably, as many have been won to Christ, not so much by an acute awareness of the horror of their sin, but by the winsomeness of Christ's love for them. It's not one response, you see, all the time to God and God's law that softens men and draws them to Him. There are at least an equal number who have been drawn by God's love and mercy and grace. In verses 15 to 34 of chapter 43, we see the way in which God uses the power of genuine love to melt the hearts of these brothers still further. You will remember that they had had an earlier encounter with the goodness of God in chapter 42 in verse 24 when they discovered that the money they had used to pay for the grain had been returned to them. But here in these verses, they are confronted with an even greater benevolence. The story begins with the brothers' fear of the kind of welcome they would receive when they return to Egypt. When they do present themselves at the Egyptian court, they are immediately invited to dine with Joseph that very day. And you'll notice that they couldn't accept this kindness, this invitation at its face value. And they were quite convinced that it was part of a plot against them. Now the men were frightened, verse 18, the men were frightened when they were taken to his house. They thought, we are brought here because of the silver that was put back into our sacks the first time. He wants to attack us and overpower us and seize us as slaves and take our donkeys. And it's against this background of fear and suspicion that Joseph's goodness unfolds. Notice in the first place they have their minds put at ease concerning the money that had been discovered in their sacks after their previous trip to Egypt. No need to worry about that. That's not the reason you're here. Secondly, they are reunited with Simeon, who was released from prison just as the prime minister had promised them. Oh, well, that's an encouraging sign. We thought we might have been brought here in order that we would be slung into prison along with our brother, but here he is, restored to us, released. Thirdly, they were given provision for their donkeys and water to wash and refresh themselves. signs of respect and courtesy in the Middle East. Not something you would do to an enemy before you either killed him or imprisoned him. And when Joseph arrived, he did not speak on this occasion harshly to them, but kindly, inquiring after their family, and unknown to them, hardly able to contain himself at the sight of his younger brother, Benjamin. And then finally, there was this sumptuous feast that had been prepared in their honor. And this was spread before the astonished brothers. Here is a dinner that began to break down all their fears and their suspicions. End of chapter 43, so they feasted and they drank freely with him. Now the brothers had enjoyed all of the benefits and the provisions of Joseph's kindness without realizing who he really was. And at this point, the story illustrates the manner in which so many people benefit from the kindness and the goodness of God without realizing they are indeed doing so. This is what theologians describe as common grace. Men and women who are not yet true disciples of Jesus Christ are just like these elder brothers. They have sinned against him. They have rejected his lordship. And he has used a variety of means to awaken them to their need and to bring them to an open confession of their sin. But they have only gone so far as God's tactics have forced them to go. And despite his good and his gracious provision, they fail to recognize him to be the author of all of these benefits. Is it not the case that by nature men and women tend to show contempt for God's kindness? Man's overweening self-confidence in the fact that he is the master of his own destiny, holds out to the bitter, bitter end. Now I want you to picture the scene as the brothers make their way back home. Oh, their hearts had been awakened by God and their consciences had truly been working overtime as a result of the activity of God. But as yet, no open confession of their sin. They had found no reason thus far to abandon themselves to the mercy of God. And I suspect they must have been congratulating themselves on how easily they had escaped from what had been a sticky situation. They had anticipated greater difficulties than those they had encountered. And as they were in the midst of their self-congratulation, God struck with a speed faster than light and exploded their self-confidence to smithereens. And it is out of this death to self-confidence experience that these men surely begin to enter newness of life. In order to understand the thrust of chapter 44, we must remind ourselves that these men had gone down to Egypt with gloomy apprehensions, suspicions, and fears. But as they left, it was with a
heightened sense of self-confidence. After all, their word concerning Benjamin and their rejection of the accusation of being spies had been proved to be true. Their truthfulness had been vindicated. Hadn't they said they were telling the truth? The fact that they had brought back to Egypt their original payment, as well as money for fresh supplies, demonstrated the fact that they were honest men. Hadn't they said, after all, that they were honest men? They considered themselves to be men of integrity. They had tried to give the money back, had they not? Well, they had forgotten the Joseph incident so many, many years before. These men had begun to persuade themselves that, after all, they were morally upright men of great integrity and honesty and truthfulness. Indeed, when the steward came and accused them of stealing the Prime Minister's cup, they felt slandered and indignant. Didn't he realize that they were men of great moral integrity and understanding? Verses 7 to 9. But they said to him, "Why does my Lord say such things? Far be it from your servants to do anything like that. You don't really know our characters if you think we could be guilty of theft. We even brought back to you from the land of Canaan the silver we found inside the mouths of our sacks. So why would we steal silver or gold from your master's house? If any of your servants is found to have it, he will die and the rest of us will become my lord's slaves." Think about it. It takes a great deal of self-confidence to offer to be sold as a slave if any one of a group to which you belong is found to have done something wrong. That was quite a claim to have made. Picture their self-confidence as sack after sack is opened, beginning with the eldest. "See, nothing there, didn't we tell you? And nothing there, didn't we tell you? And there's nothing in that, didn't we tell you? You're wasting your time here. You haven't read our characters aright." That is, until Benjamin's sack is opened and the cup is retrieved. Now, their analysis of the situation at this point is very, very interesting. They do not speculate as to how the cup got into the sack. Instead, they conclude that they are all guilty of a far more serious sin. And it is that serious sin that God is uncovering and is about to punish them for. And this point is made somewhat strangely in Judah's words to the Prime Minister in verse 16. He says, "What can we say, my Lord? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt." How can he speak of innocence and guilt in the same breath? Well, the words accurately reflect the situation. They were innocent of stealing Joseph's cup, but deeply guilty of having sold their brother into slavery. And it is a confession of guilt that is being made concerning their treatment of their brother those many years before. Here at last, we have an open, public confession of their sin. What they had attempted to keep in the darkness, God had drawn out into the light. How does the scripture put it? "Be sure your sin will find you out. These brothers, along with many, many men and women, had prided themselves in all of the positive things that they saw in their lives. Men of honesty, of truthfulness, of integrity. They had seen these things in growing measure in their lives. And they seek to protest their innocence. They are innocent of the sin of theft, but guilty of something much worse than that. This proud self-confidence points to a greater sin. This self-confidence that is found in the hearts of so many men and women points to a greater sin, a refusal to be ruled over by another, to their rejection, not of Joseph as their Lord, but of Jesus as their Lord and Savior. Time again and again, people in Joseph's brother's mold boast of their performance, their church attendance, their religious devotions, their works of charity, when in fact, to enjoy God's favor, they need to stop clinging to their own pseudo-saviors and instead cling to God for his mercy, which he mediates through the person of Christ. I want you to see that it is at exactly this point that the brother's self-righteousness and self-confidence is broken. And not a moment before this are they healed. This is the point, I submit to you, where their relationship with God is transformed. Before, they had been running away from God and seeking to cover up their sin. Now they recognize what God has done. Verse 16, "What can we say, my Lord?" Judah replied. "What can we say? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt. We stand guilty before the bar of God's justice." God had won. That's really what they're saying. God has won. We have tried to uncover our sin. We have tried to live a sham these many, many years. We have tried to pretend we are something we are not. But God has won. Some commentators consider that it is at this point that these brothers come to saving faith. We saw earlier, you will remember, in Genesis 42 and 28, the point where the brothers became aware of the fact that God was involved in their personal histories. They began then to take the fact of God seriously, no longer a remote God, but someone who was real, and that caused them to shake and to tremble. But now something much more radical than that is taking place in their lives. And this, you see, is the great climax of all that Joseph, under God, had sought to bring about in the lives of his brothers. Notice, interestingly, that he has managed to recreate the scene of many years ago when he had been sold into slavery. The brothers standing before Joseph are now in a position of relative control. Benjamin was now their father's favorite son, and it was he who was at risk, not they. What would the brothers do in this situation? All of the circumstantial evidence pointed to Benjamin's guilt. The brothers knew him to be innocent. The brothers knew too that they had promised Joseph's steward that if any of their number be found guilty, he could be enslaved. Would they now step aside and say, "Goodbye, Benjamin. It's been nice knowing you, but the guilt is yours and not ours. We want to extricate ourselves from this situation." Would they concoct yet another story to explain Benjamin's non-appearance when they returned to their father in Canaan? Well, thanks to the work of grace that God had done in these men's hearts, such a possibility did not enter their minds. Years before, they had willingly washed their hands of Joseph. There is now not one of them that did not wish the cup had been found in his sack rather than Benjamin's, because they knew themselves to be guilty in the sight of God. And to a man, they refused to abandon their brother, and collectively they returned to face the anger of the Egyptian prime minister. What a glorious transformation God has wrought in these men's lives. Again, if I can quote Charles Colson, "The kingdom of God is a kingdom of paradox, where through the ugly defeat of the cross, a holy God is utterly glorified. Victory comes through defeat, healing through brokenness, finding through losing self." Healing through brokenness, finding through losing self. And the quality of the transformation in the brothers' lives finds poignant expression in the powerfully moving appeal of Judah in verses 18 to 34 of chapter 44. Now remember, Judah has just had all of the stuffing knocked out of him. God has disclosed the darkest secret in this man's heart. His self-confidence is demolished, and it was in this state of utter brokenness that he pleads on his brother's behalf. And when we examine the substance of Judah's appeal, the focus of it is not upon his brother Benjamin in particular, in whose sack the cup had been found, nor is it upon the brothers in general, whose integrity had been called into question, but rather it is upon the threat to the life of a father for whom they seem now to have a deepening love and respect. Look at verses 30 to 31 of chapter 44. "So now, if the boy is not with us when I go back to your servant my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees that the boy isn't there, he will die. Your servants will bring the grey head of our father down to the grave in sorrow." Gone is the callous disregard for this old man's feelings. A father whom they had hurt so readily many years ago. They had seen that old man reduced in his powers
by the persuasion that Joseph, his favorite son, was dead, and they had withheld from him the truth that could have kindled hope in his grieving heart. God's treatment of Judah and his brothers had melted their heart and transformed their attitude and their actions towards one they had previously treated so shabbily. And at the very heart of this appeal, notice there is the idea of vicarious suffering. That is, of bearing the penalty and the suffering which is directed towards another. Verse 33, "Now then, please let your servant remain here as my Lord's slave in place of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers." Now we find a number of powerful appeals made to God along similar lines, which say, in effect, though you consider these individuals deserve punishment, let me suffer in their place. Think of Moses' plea before God on Mount Sinai after the Israelites had made the golden calf and begun to worship it, and God was angry with Israel and determined to blot them out. In Exodus 32, verse 32, we read of Moses saying, "Now please forgive their sin. Then, if not, blot me out of the book you have written." Moses, in effect, is asking to be sent to hell if that could result in the salvation of a people he had come to love. He wanted to save the Jewish nation in exactly the same spirit of vicarious self-sacrifice which Judah displays here. Or turning to the New Testament, to the 9th chapter of the Epistle to the Romans, Paul describes there the unbelief and the rejection of Israel of Jesus, their Messiah. And in the 3rd verse, Paul writes, "I could wish that I myself were cursed and cut off from Christ for the sake of my brothers, those of my own race." It broke Paul's heart to think that the bulk of the Jewish nation had rejected Jesus. And he is saying, "I would endure hell if it meant they could be saved from the folly of their rejection." What love he had for his brother Jews. It drew out the same spirit of vicarious self-sacrifice which we find here in Judah's heart. And all three examples, of course, do no more than reflect the character of the love of God as it is expressed in the coming of Jesus as our substitute and as our representative to bear our sufferings and to say, "I will endure their hell, but they might enjoy my heaven." The difference being that he was not only willing to suffer, he did suffer. And he suffered not for people just like himself. He suffered the just for the unjust, that he might bring us to God. Ours was a sinless substitute, who by his self-sacrifice made clear the quality of love which God has for such unlovely folk as you and I. Now, the point is that this same sacrificial love is found in the heart of the once callous, hard-hearted Judah.
He put his concern for his father and his concern for his brother's welfare before his own interests. And by so doing, he exhibited something of the love of Christ. He demonstrated that a fundamental transformation had taken place in his heart. You see, God has been at work in this man's life. And the result is absolutely glorious. Those who had known Judah in earlier years would have rubbed their eyes in disbelief. Could this be the same man, the Judah they had once known? No, he's not the same man. He is a different man. A man made different by God's grace. A man whose conscience had been awakened. A man who had been brought to an end of himself. A man whose life is now under new management. I don't know what kind of response Joseph had been looking for when he devised this test for his brothers. But whatever he had hoped for, he could surely not have wished for anything better than this. Are we capable of seeing what God has accomplished in the events recorded in chapters 42 and 43 and 44 of Genesis? All of the difficulties and hardships through which God has brought these brothers had a glorious object in view. And they demonstrate, you see, the lengths to which God will go in the lives of men and women who have suppressed their consciences and hardened their hearts against Him. Does it begin to help us to see the tremendous value that God places on our lives, to see the lengths to which He will go to do His transforming work, so that people looking at us will rub their eyes in disbelief and ask, could this be the same person? I knew those many years ago. And our reply to that is no. It is not the same person. This is a person who has been transformed by God's grace. And if that doesn't want to make us sing, then nothing will.